So this is our third shiur of Torah and government. We've spent 2 weeks studying Dina D'Malchus Adina, and this will be the third and final week that we will spend studying Dina D'Malchus Adina. Hope to move next week. I think we'll probably study some of the laws of going to secular court, because that is something that we are really going to begin to bleed into this week. So I think it will be a very nice transition. Maybe we'll do a week on that. If we could do a little bit on monarchy and democracy, I think that would be fun also. And that'll wrap up this unit of this class for the fall. Just recap quickly the main points that we've covered in the last couple of weeks before we move on to the shiur for tonight. We have analyzed a couple of models for understanding this law, this really mysterious halacha, right, of Dina D'Malchus Adina. It's like the comment that the Mesillas Yesharim has, that there are lines that are things that we're so familiar with, we don't pause to think about. But Dina D'Malchus Adina, we hear it thrown around all the time, but we never, think to, how does it actually make any sense? Right? We have a Torah system. Where does it come from that some civil law, some government in medieval Spain or something has halachic authority? Where exactly does that come from? So we've seen a discussion of this, and the two main models we had were the Rashbam, who argued that it comes from the people below, the idea that it's the consent of the governed. If you live in a country, that means that you're signing up for its laws. And on the other hand, the view of the Tosfot, quoted by the Ran, that, not from the ground up, from the top down, that it's rooted in the fact that ultimately the sovereign owns the land, he owns the country, and if you're living on his land, so you have to deal with, let's say, his taxes. We saw a couple of, several differences and consequences between these two primary models, and the main ones were how is there an idea of unjust Dina D'Malchus Adina? If you think that Dina D'Malchus is rooted in the fact that the king owns the land, he can do whatever he wants on his land. So he can pass whatever property taxes on whoever he wants, because ultimately it belongs to him. And then you have to reread the Gemara, which seemed to suggest otherwise. But if you think that Dina D'Malchus Adina is rooted in the consent of the governed, so then you are going to wonder, right, whenever there's a law, is this something that the governed consented to or not? Is this something that we've signed up for or is it not? We saw that get bounced around between the Ramban and the Trumas HaDeshen. If you have a law that is new, did people sign up for that? That was a debate in the Rishonim. If you have a law which seems discriminatory, so we spoke about the jizya last week, right, the tax that was applied exclusively to Jews, and the surprising conclusion that, well, it's applied across the board, and we know that that's what you're signing up for. If you move to the Ottoman Empire, you move to an Islamic country, they tax Jews at double the rate they tax Muslims. That is an across-the-board tax. We know what we're signing up for. So does that fall under Dina D'Malchus Adina? That was one set of questions. And then the other set of questions was jurisdiction. What does this apply to? And here things were reversed. And we said that if you were a royalist and you said that Dina D'Malchus Adina really was rooted in the ownership of the king, so when it comes to his land, his territory, he can do whatever he wants, but he can't do anything outside of that, right? So he can call the shots on property taxes because it's his land, but he's not going to call the shots on subtle details in civil law. What's the, what are speed limits going to be in the interstate? That might not be something that, falls under, maybe that, but what about, details of how loan deals are going to be structured might not fall under his jurisdiction. As opposed to, if you think that Dina D'Malchus is rooted under, you live in a country, you accept its laws, then that can apply to a much broader framework. And then we ended the last year, last week, where we spoke a little bit about America. We'll speak more about America tonight, God willing. right? Because if you think of Dino de Malchus as rooted in what the governed consent to, so that might depend on the nature of the country, right? And we proposed that if you had somehow some tax that was passed in America, and we discussed like the Jim Crow laws as an example, if you have something which might have been normal in the Ottoman Empire, but it goes against the founding creed of the country you're living in, so that would not necessarily fall under Dina de Malchus Adina, right? If it goes against what has normally been agreed to by the people of the country, then that's not going to fly, right? When King George taxed the tea, so you know, if the King of France if Louis XIV wants to tax tea, he can do whatever he wants, right? But you're King George and you try to tax tea and the colonists, that's not what we signed up for, right? So it can depend. It can vary from country to country. And we saw Rav Moshe Feinstein's discussion of America as a malchut shel chesed and some of the consequences of that. So the time that we'll spend tonight is mostly we're going to, you know, ask the hard question, the elephant in the room. And namely, we can talk about the authority of Dina de Malchus Adina, but what happens when it goes up against Torah law, right? We've explained how the Torah can leave a space for an alternative legal system. But what do we do when they come head to head? What does that clash look like? Where are we going to end up? That is mostly how we're going to spend the time this year tonight. So I'll share the screen. There's one source I want to look at before we dive into that topic, because it's really going to, I think, illustrate what the Rishonim and Achronim were dealing with. What did some of these legal systems look like? When we talk about unfair taxation, let's get a fairly graphic example of what we've had to put up with over the centuries. There's a tshuva in the back of the Rivash. The Rivash lives in the late 1300s, at the end, lives mostly in Christian Spain. At the end of his life, has to run away to North Africa after the pogroms and forced conversions in Spain of 1391. So the Machon Yerushalayim has published two volumes of his tshuvot. There are a bunch of tshuvot in the back, which they say have been traditionally ascribed to him, but actually they say were written by, I think, his son-in-law. So there's one over here. I'm not sure which country it's talking about, but the Rivash's son-in-law gets a question, and he says there were two or three Jews. There were Shaimo Shasha Yehudim, who were in charge of the finance ministry for some local kingdom. Now this was common. You know, Abarbanel was the finance minister in Spain throughout the, you know, late medieval, early modern Islamic period. Jews were prominently involved in the finance departments of various Islamic governments. So there were some Jews who were in charge of the coinage, and the Rivash's son-in-law gets a tshuva that they were caught playing around with the currency, which is kind of a catastrophic crime, because that can ruin the whole, you know, economic system if people find out that the coins they've been using are not worth what they actually thought they were. So those two or three guys are in trouble, right? Tshuva doesn't say what happened to them, but I assume it didn't go well. But the king does not just react against the three finance ministers he had who were cheating on the coinage. The letter says that he was going to expel all the Jews from the entire country. And what do? We bought them off, right? We promised a bribe of thousands of golden coins, right? So, okay, the Jews pay a few thousand gold coins. They pay a fortune. They'll be allowed to stay in the country. And then the king appointed assessors to determine how much money each member of the Jewish community is going to have to pay. One poor guy, call him Reuven, gets assessed, I think, 50 golden florins. That's a fortune, tens of thousands of dollars he has to pay because he's a member of the Jewish community. He begs, he doesn't have the money. They force him to pay more. They throw him in jail. They drag him with his eye, with his handcuffed to the local tax collector. They start beating him up. And long story short, he has to, he promises he doesn't have any more money. He accepts, I guess they knew about Nazir, because he accepts that he'll be an eternal Nazir, a Nazir Shimshon. If he ever comes back to town after having paid less than they arbitrarily decided he was supposed to pay, so then he writes the letter to the Ravasha's son-in-law asking, was this vow effective, right? Did he halachically obligate himself? If he comes back home eventually, will he actually have to live his life as a Nazir Shimshon? Ravasha's son-in-law writes back and he says, this is a case where we will not say Dina de Malchusa Dina, right? This tax that was passed by the king on the entire Jewish community with no specificity how much or how little was going to be assigned to every individual person. He says halacha does not recognize this as a legitimate tax. He has a couple of great lines here. I just wanted to highlight some of them. He says, "Ha'ashir yarbev hadal yamid." Right? He's not going to make sure that the rich pay more. He's not going to make sure that the poor pay less. What probably happened? If you were well off, you probably bribed the local tax collector, and you got some slack. And those in the community who have fewer connections are having to pay more of the burden. And he says, hey, let's think of this case. Two or three Jews, are commit crimes and the entire community is going to suffer for it. The king can make that declaration, but that is not something that we recognize as halachically valid. He says that's gezel gamur etzlenu. That's full-fledged theft. Doesn't matter if it's coming from the king. This is a case that's too far. And just one line he has, which is great because it fits in with the Parshas HaShavua. He says, what does this look like? You know, the entire community suffering for the crime of two or three people. He says, Al kayotze bo amar Avraham avinu alav Hashem lakadosh baruch hu. Avraham said to Hashem when he was davening for Sodom, Chalila lacha me'asos kadavar hazeh. Right? God forbid that you would do this. Lahamis tzadik im rasha. Right? To slay the innocent with the guilty. So the Rebbeinu Shalom is not going to behave that way, but the king of whatever local emirate did, right? So Ravasha's son-in-law writes, this is a case of we will call gazlanusa de malchus. This is theft. It doesn't matter if it's coming from the king. This is a bridge too far. So I just wanted to present this as an example to illustrate when we talk about what halacha recognizes as valid and what it doesn't. Like, this just shows what we've had to put up with over the centuries in the Gaulis. Okay, so now let's move, cut to the chase, and ask the key question: what do we do when Torah clashes with the law of the land? If we talk about taxation, tax policy, there's no such issue, right? There's no such problem for taxes. The Torah doesn't say the king can't pass taxes. That has nothing to do with any halacha. On the other hand, let's pick another extreme. We talk about the Hanukkah story. Nobody ever imagined that Matasyahu and Yehuda Maccabi are saying Mila Shem Elai, no more pigs on the Mizbeach. But what do you mean? Antiochus declared Dina de Malchusa Dina, right? No one's ever going to say that is the case. When it comes to Issa V'Heter, when it comes to things we're prohibited from doing, the Romans ban us from learning Torah, Kashrus or Bris Mila is prohibited. There's no possibility of Dina de Malchusa Dina. The real questions are in civil law, right? When in Choshen Mishpat, you open up Choshen Mishpat, and it says you're supposed to have halacha X, Y, and Z, and you look in the civil code of whatever country you're in, and it says you're supposed to do A, B, and C, what is the result, right? That is where things really get messy. And so the foundational piece is a tshuva of the Rashba, the giant in Spain in the 1200s, student of Rabbeinu Yonah and the Ramban. And the Rashba gets an inheritance question. It's a tragic case. What happens? Mazel Tov, two people get married. The wife brings a very nice dowry into the marriage, and they have a baby. And then within a year, I think of the marriage, actually, I think I'm very quickly, it probably was complications from childbirth, both the young wife and the infant die. So now, you know, they get up from Shiva, and what immediately happens afterwards? The father demands from his, you know, son-in-law to return the dowry, because, you know, when you married my now deceased daughter, you know, the plan was to have a large family, but now I want my money back. Now, according to halacha, there's no shaila here, because the husband inherits his wife, right? That's the end. But in medieval Spain, apparently the law was that if the marriage ended within a year, the dowry reverts to the father of the bride. So you have a clash between the law of the land, which dictates returning the dowry to the father, and Hilchos Yerusha, which dictate the husband inheriting his wife's fortune. So who is going to win? That's the question that's presented to the Rashba. And the Rashba basically goes ballistic. If you look at source number three, just the bold line on top, he says, Omer ani, I say, Shakol hasomich bazel lomar shemutter. Anyone who says that it's permissible to rely on the local law and return the dowry. Mishem dina de machusa. You're going to invoke dina de machusa, civil law here. Toe the gazlan hu, he's mistaken. That's bad. He's a thief. It's a lot worse. Ugzele yashiv. And you're making him repay theft to the father. Then he writes a little more, and he says, hey, you know, at this rate, if we're going to rely on the civil code for inheritance law, so now the Rashi gets a little sarcastic. It's not often you see Rishonim getting, you know, openly cynical, but you got to read this line. He says, Ma lanu l'sifrei hakodesh hamikudashim. Why do we need the Shulchan Aruch or the Rambam or the Gemara? Shechavru lanu Rebbe. We don't need a Mishnah. The Acher of Ravina Veravashi. Throw out Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra. Right? Don't send anybody to learn the Gemara anymore. It's useless. Yilmedu es b'nehem dinei hagoyim. Send your kids to law school. V'yavinu lahem bamasa t'luos. They can build up altars. Bebeit medrasei hagoyim. They can go to the non-Jewish based medrash. Right, they can learn up a storm in what, you know, King James of Aragon says is what inheritance law should look like. And Rashba says this is unacceptable. Chalila lot yekazos b'Yisrael chas v'shalom. God forbid this should be the case. Shema tachgor hatorah aleh sak, lest the Torah wear sackcloth. That's a very inspiring and energetic line. But let's take a step back and ask, okay, that's very nice. But why not say Dina de Malchusadina, right? Where exactly and how exactly do we draw the line? And then you have this whole paragraph here where, after banging his fist on the table, so the Rashba steps back and he says, you know, the truth is the question of Dina de Malchusadina, Yagati Harbe. I have stayed up many nights trying to figure out when exactly we will or will not apply Dina de Malchusadina, because the truth is, it's really complicated. When do we say we'll go with what Choshen Mishpat has to say, what the Halacha has to say, and when do we go with what Dina de Malchusa has to say? And he presents a couple of possibilities. He quotes some that we saw earlier from the Ramban. Maybe it depends on if it's official on the books law or if it's just in the common law. Maybe things depend on if it's permanent regular law or if it's periodical decrees from the king. And then one suggestion he makes at the bottom, which will be important for us going forward, he says, you know, one thing that makes a lot of sense that matters is what was the intent of the parties when they entered an agreement, right? If you have two parties who enter a loan agreement, let's say, we'll see this described more in depth in a couple of minutes. So if they agreed to use the American legal system, so then you could argue that should dictate the terms of the agreement, as opposed to the case that the Rashbah here is actually dealing with of inheritance law. There was no agreement to speak of over here, right? It's just who inherits the wife's fortune, right? This is where, you know, the whole discussion of halachic wills comes into the picture, because we do not recognize the the civil law as having automatic authority in this area. So the Rashba puts the problem front and center. There are all the time clashes between the civil law and the halacha of Choshen Mishpat. And when that is the case, which system do we go with? How do we determine when we say Dina de Malchusa Dina, and when we say, like the Rashba said over here, absolutely not, you know, we might as well just throw out Baba Kama and go to the base medrase Hagayim. What determines that, right? That's the core problem. Okay, so what we'll do is we'll look at Shulchan Aruch. We'll look at, you know, a heated debate between Shulchan Aruch and the Shach, and a couple of theories to explain some of the rulings here, and then a case study, and then we'll close with a couple of thoughts, perspectives about modern America. Okay, source number four, Shulchan Aruch. So Shulchan Aruch is talking here about loan deals. You loan someone money with a mashkon, right? You'll loan money with, and there's collateral. So the Shulchan Aruch, you know, what happens if the person can't pay up? You have their collateral, they couldn't pay. So how long do you have to wait before you can just take the collateral, right? You know, you had a year to pay the loan. Loan is due. You didn't pay up. That's it, right? And now I get to keep the collateral. Shulchan Aruch quotes two views. How much time the lender has before he's allowed to seize the collateral as payment. First view is the minute that the borrower doesn't pay up, it's immediately yours. Second view, Shulchan Aruch quotes, and that's what he quotes in this sif over here, is that there's a grace period for 30 days. You get a month before you can keep the mashko. Right, that's a machlokas. It's an old machlokas, and the Shulchan Aruch quotes both views. So then the Ramah jumps in. And the Ramah says, you know, the truth is, it's not so simple that these are the only two possibilities. There is a third option. Let's look at it, the red line over here, source number four. He says, V'yesh omrim. There are those who say, D'bamakom shehaminhag, the places where the custom is, shehamalvat legoyim lo yuchal lemachro v'pachos mi shana. In places when you're dealing with, you know, lending money to non-Jews, that you have to wait a year before you can sell the collateral and keep the proceeds as payment. Dun in Cain, gam b'Yisrael. We will apply that law as well when dealing with a Jewish borrower. Shehelvel achavero al hamashkon. If you have a Jew, right, who's borrowing money with collateral. De azlinan bazeh achar haminhag. We will go after the common custom. So Ramah says, halacha, there's a machlokas if you wait 30 days or keep the collateral right away. But the local practice in Poland is you have a year. Anytime you enter a loan agreement with a non-Jew, you have to wait a year before you can sell the collateral. So he quotes the Mordechai as saying that we have to wait a year as well. It sounds like Dina Demachusa Dina, the civil law of waiting a year, is overcoming what the Gemara says, right? You only have to wait 30 days. That is the view of the Ramah. And the Shach, right? Main commentator on Choshen Mish. But Shach goes ballistic. And I quote only a few lines, but it's a Shach. It's like one page on one side of Shulchan Aruch, and then another page side, another page of Shulchan Aruch. He goes on for like, you know, if you printed the whole thing, it's probably, you know, a nice 5-6 pager. As I was printing out the source sheet tonight, it says I was low on ink. If I printed out the whole Shach, it would have been all gone, right? So he's not happy at all, right? And just look at the bold, right? He quotes those lines from the Rashba earlier. He says the Ramat, you're undoing Torah law. He says, how can we learn from Gentile law? Levatel din Torah, to nullify the halacha, chas v'shalom lo tehi kazos b'Yisrael. Right? God forbid we should have this. You know, the Rashba was talking about how if we go overboard with our enthusiasm for Dina de Malchus Adina, right? So no one is going to need to buy a Shulchan Aruch, right? No one's going to need to buy a Gemara. So the Shach, you know, is basically telling the Rama, you're going to be putting yourself out of business, right? You know, the Rama, Choshen Mishpat is like 369 simanim. Why do you spend so much time, right? Just go to Polish law school. So the Shach says very, very firmly, says we have an ironclad rule across the board, right? Says, you know, regardless, and he has a discussion, what's the jurisdiction of Dina de Malchusa, things we've discussed, if it's for the personal benefit of the king, if it's for the general benefit of society. But the Shach says, I don't care how wide a net Dina de Malchusa has. Afilu l'shar poskim de sovrim, even the other poskim, who said that we say Daladad, we say Dina de Malchusa, Bechol Davar, right? We'll give the widest berth, property taxes, civil litigation, across the board. Dafka ma she'eno neged din Torasenu. We can only say Dina de Malchusa if it's not against the Torah. That's it. Period. End of story. Right? Bechol davar neged Torasenu, anything that's against the Torah, chalila vadai lo yasa king b'Yisrael. If there's ever a situation where the halacha says X and the civil law says Y, the Shach is a hardliner and he says we just go with halacha. So you have then this fundamental machlokas between the Rama and the Shach. The Shach is saying if there's a clash, conversation's over, right? Doesn't matter if it's, you know, the Greeks shachting a pig on the Mizbeach. And it doesn't matter if it's the Poles telling you that you have to wait a year before you can sell your mashko. We don't care. We go with the halacha. Period. End of story. And the Rama is somehow saying that things are more complicated. Now, who we paskin like is a machlokas, but by and large, it seems like we paskin like the Rama, that actually civil law plays a much greater role in halachic adjudication of civil disputes. But we need to ask, like, why? I mean, the Shach has a good question. There's a reason why he went on for 5 pages. And there's a reason why, you know, if he had had color print, he probably would have put those lines in red and bold also, right? What on earth is the Rama thinking? There is a halacha mida de malchus adina. So like, the classic response to the Shach, you have already in Regionus and Ibishitz, the Urim Tumim, it's quoted right here, source number 6 in the Archa Shulchan. It was already referenced by the Rashba as well. The Aruch HaShulchan, the Tumim, they say, look, you have a Jew who's in money lending, right? All day long, he's lending money. And what are the policies that he adopts? Let's say, you know, 80% of his clientele are not Jewish. So the standard practice he has is he just lends money in accordance with the laws of the land. And the same is true for the borrowers. When you're borrowing money, you know, 80% of the bankers, let's say, were not Jewish. You know, it's more true later as you get closer to the Ramah's time than it was earlier. But that's you know, the standard business practice was you had a year to sell your mashkon. So, writes the Aruch HaShulchan, and when you have the situation over here, it's not a clash between Dina de Malchusa on the one hand and the halacha on the other hand. It's just very simply, when the two people entered the loan agreement, we presume that they agreed to standard business practice. And most loans in this area are done with the ability to wait a year before the lender has the rights to the collateral, right? It says it's just v'hava ki'ilu hisnakin. It's as if they stipulated a condition. That's an idea that was not relevant to the inheritance case because there was no agreement happening over there. They got married and then there was a Yerusha problem. But when you have an agreement between parties, writes the Aruch HaShulchan, the reason that the Ramah said will go with the common business practice according to local civil law is because we assume that that is what the parties have agreed to. It happens to be, if you go through the rules and procedures of the Bezdin of America, so this is an explicit clause in their rules and procedures, right? What are they right here? Parties to dispute explicitly or implicitly. Or implicitly. That's exactly what their Aruch HaShulchan is saying, right? Ki'ilu hisne. They implicitly accept the common commercial practices of any particular trade, profession, or community, right? Whether it be by explicit incorporation or implicit adoption, the Beis Din will accept such common commercial practices as providing the rules of decision governing the decision of the panel to the fullest extent permitted by Jewish law. So the Beis Din of America is literally putting the Aruch HaShulchan in its rules and procedures. But that is how we can have the relevance of civil law, because it's not a clash between Din of the Malchus and Halacha, it's just simply what the parties are agreeing to. That's one model, and it's a very important one. So, for example, Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he's asked about a bankruptcy case, right? The halacha is if someone lent money to five different people, so the first creditor gets to collect his entire debt, and if there's any money left, the second creditor takes whatever he can get, and then we go on and on, right? So the question to Rav Moshe was, you know, in bankruptcy court, they're going to be dividing up the assets among the various creditors. That is not in line with what the halacha would dictate. So Rav Moshe responds, he says, yeah, sorry, this is a case where we're going to go with Dina de Malchus Adina, because when you made the loan agreement, when you agreed to lend the guy the money, the presumption was you were doing so according to the laws of American civil law, according to American bankruptcy law, and now you can't come running after the debtor's gone bankrupt and saying you want the bankruptcy to be handled according to what Chosha Mishpat would say. Because we assume when you lent him the money, you did so assuming that bankruptcy would be a relevant option. This idea of the assumed condition. But there's a second model. It's a really, really interesting one. Rav Yaakov Ariel, the Rosh Yeshiva of Ramat Gan, points out. He quotes the Chassam Sofer. Chassam Sofer, I don't know the exact history of the case, but it's at some point where there's like there's a crisis in wine supply. So the local officials, you know, they're applying certain price controls. Right? There are certain supply limits. I forgot the details of the case, but there's certainly nothing like this in the halacha that we could, you know, demand that you do that. So Chassam Sofer gets the question, and Chassam Sofer says, well, you know, the truth is, this sounds like a very reasonable thing to do. Right, if the goal is to ensure the economic viability of the market, well, that sounds like the local officials are doing something very reasonable. And says Chassam Sofer, here's the key idea: had we been in charge, had the Beis Din had jurisdiction of the town, ilu ba lefaneinu, had they come to us, hayinu gamkin misaknim kain, right? The Beis Din would have passed a rule like this if there was some, you know, if the Beis Din was running the Federal Reserve and, you know, the economists say we had to slash interest rates, so the Chassam Sofer would slash the interest rates, right? It just happens to be the Beis Din isn't the one calling the shots. So the Chassam Sofer puts a second model here. He says, had we been the ones in charge, there would be takanos. There would be new decree, right? There are plenty of from Yehoshua when Bnei Yisrael first come into the land of Israel through the Gaonim and afterwards. there are decrees, new monetary rules and regulations that were put in by various Bate Din as responses to certain economic changes. So Chassam Sofer says, you have to recognize the Dina de Machusa of the town in this case, because the only difference between them and us is they're the ones calling the shots. But we would have done the exact same thing. So that presents a second potential model for understanding why sometimes we would go with the civil law when there's a clash between what it says in Choshen Mishpat and what it says in civil law, because the argument could be made. Let's take the bankruptcy case, for example, that given the complexity of economic dealings in the 21st century, had we had a civil law that was exclusively governed by halacha, we probably would have to have many more takanos than we actually do, right? We basically use the civil law in many areas, and had the weight of jurisdiction fallen entirely on the shoulders of the Beis Din, we would have to have put into place many similar takanos to what the civil law already has. So many clashes between Choshen Mishpat and Dina de Malchusa might just be because we, the Beis Din, is not actually in charge of calling the shots. That's a second model that Yaakov Ariel points out from this Chassam Sofer. Very interesting idea. So you have then these two ways of you know, considering how we navigate Dina de Malchusa versus civil law. On the one, right, the classic idea, we just think about what the parties agreed to. And then the second one, which, you know, I think is like more fundamental, is would we ourselves have had to have passed a similar decree had we had total jurisdiction over the case? So just to present a case study, hang on a second, screen share for a second, a case study that illustrates how some of this can get really complicated. So Rabbi Jachter, in one of his volumes of Gray Matter, has a really interesting case from Israel. There was a debate in the Beis Din in Sderot between the Rabbanim disagreed as to how to paskin. And he presents only the minority view, the losing view, because it didn't win the day. What was the case? There was a guy who had a little business. And he had a secretary, and he fired his secretary. Now, okay, great, he fired his secretary. Problem is, his secretary was pregnant. And according to Israeli law, you cannot fire a pregnant employee unless you get unless you have a special permit, apparently, justifying the firing. So now she demands, you know, back pay. Now he says, well, I'm not firing you because didn't do a good job. I'm firing you because the business is about to go under. Which, sure enough, the business a couple months go by and the business he goes out of business. He just wasn't making any money. So the question was presented to the Beis Din. They wrote, would we say Dina de Malchusa Dina over here? Apply the law which says, hey, look, you no matter what you need to have filed for a permit to fire the woman. He tried to get one retroactively. That's unacceptable. Or will we say, look, let's adopt common sense over here. What is the reason why Israeli law has a provision that you have to get permits before you can fire people who are pregnant? It's because we don't, you know, it's a disaster for society to have people callously firing people as soon as they get pregnant. That's not good. But if the reason he's firing her is not because of discrimination of any kind, he's obviously firing her because he can't make payroll. So does it make any sense over there? The Dina de Malchusa Dina does not make any sense in that case. We've found a situation where the rationale for the civil law does not apply. So should we apply the civil law anyway, even though had it been up to us, for example, right? Had we been passing the Takanos, we never would have formulated it in such a way that you have to get special permission, no matter what, even though it was clear why he was firing her in that situation, or not. Complicating the case, right? Let's actually think about that for a minute, right? So the Dayanim disagreed. On one hand, the argument was, sorry, Dina de Malchusa Dina, right? Presumably, they signed up for whatever laws were on the books. The dissenting response says two things. Number one, the law in this case doesn't make any sense. He was letting her go because he couldn't pay her. Number two, do we really think that they had looked and scoured every detail of labor employment before she was hired? Did he know or did she know that if you get pregnant, then you have to have a special permit before you can be terminated, and that can't be applied for retroactively? Who knows if that was known? Can we really say that that was implicitly agreed to? Very unclear. Complicating it a little bit, apparently, the employee, the secretary, he had told her that times are tough. He's not going to make payroll for much longer. He has to let her go. And she said, "Can I stay employed for 3 months so that I can qualify for unemployment insurance?" So okay, he squeezes out 3 months to keep her on the payroll, and then after it's done, right? She now turns around and demands back pay, right? And demands further compensation even for those 3 months. So, you have a situation where the she's acting not so much on the up and up, right? So what's the result? The Bezdin paskined in her favor. They said Dina de Malchusa Dina, but this is a case where you had a dissenting view, right? Because on one hand, this is not something that we ever would have decreed, because it's being applied in a case where it makes no sense. He's letting her go because he can't make payroll. And it's not so clear that, they had really agreed to this in the first place. There's something fishy going on here. So this is like an example of how the limits can be tested. So just to go back to the source sheet for 1 minute. So if we close out Dina the Malchusa Dina, there's a point that's pertinent to democracies that a number of people make. In the YU world, Rabbi Schechter makes it most prominently, that we have to think with a different paradigm about Dina de Malchusa in a democracy than we do in a monarchy. And that is because of the question of citizenship, right? That first tshuva that we had, the Rivash's son-in-law with the capricious king who's banning all of, is going to throw out all the Jews unless they pay the massive bribe. So we're living there as subjects of the king. And ultimately, the government treasury, in a sense, basically, either literally or figuratively, belongs to the ruler, right? In Rome, the fiscus was actually the private treasury of it was a private bank account of the emperor. So, Schechter points out that when we talk about a democracy and taxation, particularly in a democracy, it doesn't really have the same conceptual basis, because the Rivash is talking about Dina de Malchusa as obligating you to pay the rulers of the land. You live in the country, you sign up to pay their taxes. They declare their taxes, you got to pay up. But in a democracy, it's not what it is. A democracy, points out, really is more of a partnership. There's no one person or one group of people ruling the country. What's the deal with taxes? We are citizens, and we collect money from each other to pay for the common good, right? He says, we're really, really shutzfin. And so if that's the case, when we talk about taxation in particular, it's no longer a question of giving the king his money, right? Or does the king have the right to demand money or not? But rather it is stealing from his partners, right? It's the idea of citizenship, essentially, that in a democracy, the government is a joint endeavor of all the members of society. If you're an American citizen, that means that you are a partner in the venture of America. And when you're paying your taxes, that's not to some third party. That is a contribution to a mutually entered into reality. So it points out, we have to think of Dina de Malchusa fundamentally differently in America, right? Because we're partners with each other, and paying taxes is the primary example. It's not some third party. It's, you know, no different from having a local, you know, the local business, everyone in the local town is assessed to join in to pay for X, Y, and Z. Well, this is true here. It's a partnership, and therefore that's responsibility that falls on everyone. And just as a closing thought, you know, we think about Dina de Malchusa and the different models that we've seen for it, and the limits of it, and the differences between monarchies and democracies, and our obligations as subjects versus our rights as citizens. So, you know, especially as we close on election day tomorrow. So this this letter from Rav Moshe about voting, I think, is a really perfect way to end this mini unit. This letter that Rav Moshe wrote in 1984. Hopefully, it's clear enough on the pasting it from online, where he talks about the obligation to vote, and emphasizes the aspect of citizenship. Right, he talks about Hakaras HaTov, which we saw last week when he talked about the Malchus Shel Chesed. Right, he says it's incumbent upon each Jewish citizen to participate in the democratic system which guards the freedoms we enjoy. What's fundamental responsibility incumbent upon each individual is to register and to vote. And I think an extension of that, fundamentally what he's getting at, and what Rashad was getting at in the previous source, was the same element, right? That we have to think of ourselves as citizens. We have to think of ourselves as partners in society. That has consequences for the obligation to vote, as Moshe is talking about here. That has halachic consequences for how we conceive of our relationship to the society and its laws, the Dina de Malchusa, and I think that's, you know, it's thoughtful, and I think at least personally I find it inspiring. So that's we'll stop there for tonight, and wish everyone a good week, and looking forward to getting together again next week on our next topic of Torah and government.